This week on Your Western Context, BC Energy moves forward while prices increase. Silence on Bill C-69 shows government apathy for Alberta. Trudeau is committing to billions in spending, but not to debates. And a re-elected Trudeau government will double the carbon tax. This is Western Context, episode 133, recorded Friday, August 30th, 2019. Debating energy. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back again once more before Labor Day weekend, and we do have a good boatload of news to discuss this week, so we're going to have a chat about that, but first, welcome back to our listeners.
Yes, indeed. We've got quite a bit of news here at the end of August. It's hard to believe that it's already happening, that we're starting to move into fall. But here we are, and we've got lots to talk about this week, and certainly lots that the media has talked about, but they've been trying to throw other stories out there to kind of distract from the real news, whereas we're actually going to be talking about the real news this week.
Indeed. And, you know, we've been doing this since January 2017. And what we've been doing since then is what we aim to do is provide all the information and context necessary to put yourselves on the right side of the news. And in doing so, we hope to remove all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media. And, you know, with that, we as we mentioned, we do have a lot of news to discuss this week, and we're going to actually get started with the BC story, something that many people might not have heard about.
Yeah, that's for sure. And with all the news surrounding the upcoming federal election, John Horgan and the BC NDP government, they've kind of flown under the radar this summer so far. We haven't really even talked about John Horgan or the BC government very much this summer because, quite frankly, they haven't really been doing anything that's really been that noteworthy. It's kind of just been business as usual in BC, which, you know, always tends to happen, it seems. But there, in the last couple of weeks, there's been a concerted focus on natural resources, which has probably been one of the weaker files for the NDP during their minority government so far. So there's been a few announcements that have kind of shored up that particular file. And on the 29th, Trudeau was in Surrey with the Minister of Fisheries and North Vancouver Liberal MP Jonathan Wilkinson, as well as John Horgan, to make an announcement that both the federal and provincial governments, as well as BC Hydro, which is the main energy producer for the province, have formed an agreement to push projects that increase power transmission. And the end goal of the increased power transmission will be to electrify the natural gas industry rather than basing it off of fossil fuels. Now, the natural gas industry as it stands right now produces about 18% of the carbon pollution in the province. And the agreement was to apparently take advantage of BC Hydro's ability to provide clean energy for the industry. The three-page agreement says that $680 million in, quote, near-term electrification projects are being considered for possible funding. Now, environmental groups and Andrew Weaver's Green Party have criticized John Horgan's NDP government for its backing of the LNG industry in BC. The federal and the provincial governments have boosted LNG Canada's plans for a $40 billion project in Kitimat, which we've talked about on the show before, and that project is expected to create 10,000 construction jobs and up to 950 permanent positions in the processing terminal on the coast of BC. And Trudeau said that Thursday's agreement builds on that project. Now, most of the natural gas sent to the refinery at Kitimat would be shipped to Asia, which still has a sizable portion of their industry running off of coal. Now, it's a huge part of Horgan's climate plan, which sees changing other countries' habits from hard methods of pollution, like coal, into less polluting natural gas. And ever since the approval of Site C, this NDP government has seen an approval rating of energy projects unprecedented for an NDP government in BC, with the notable elephant in the room exception of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, of course. Now, balancing a massive natural resource industry with the environment is a tightrope that Horgan appears willing to walk. However, it's not been all sunshine and daisies. As part of Horgan's push to, quote, make life more affordable for British Columbians, which is a quote that we heard quite frequently during the campaign back in 2017, he promised to freeze BC hydro rate increases. However, he abandoned that promise very early on in 2018 after failing to persuade the commission that the freeze was affordable. As a result, hydro proceeded with a rate increase scheduled under the previous Liberal government of 3%, which was effective on April 1st, 2018. But never fear, because on the 27th, just a day before the announcement of LNG Canada, Energy Minister Michelle Mungall had a glowing and proud report to make surrounding BC Hydro. It said, quote, British Columbians will pay less for electricity next spring if the BC Utilities Commission approves BC Hydro's request for a decrease in rates. I am thrilled that BC Hydro is now able to apply for a rate reduction for the first time. However, if you actually read beyond the first few paragraphs of the release, one discovered that the overall direction on hydro rates was neither as thrilling nor as affordable as the New Democrats were actually making out. If you put together the 2018 and the 2019 increases together with those proposed for 2021 and 23, and then subtracting the tentative 2020 and 2022 decreases, one comes up with actually an overall increase of 9.2%, or about 9.5% compounded. And Hydro believes that a 1% increase adds about $16 annually to the average Hydro bill. So at the end of 6 years, the cumulative impact of 9.5% would be in about the $150 range per year. Now, whether that seems like a lot would depend on your family's budget, of course, but it would be a stretch to say that a $150 increase would be coming along with a promise to make life more affordable. Now, as for insane gas prices, the BC Utilities Commission also delivered the results of a gas price inquiry that was undertaken at the direction of the NDP to find out why gas prices had been shooting up at an unexplained rate. Horgan ordered the gas price inquiry in May, back when prices at the pump reached $1.70 per liter in the Lower Mainland, and he was saying that the public deserves answers about why prices are so much more expensive and variable than in other jurisdictions. At the time, the BC Liberals and the Alberta government both bought ads blaming Horgan and linking his government's resistance to the Trans Mountain pipeline expansion and taxes to the surging costs. Now, the commission's marching orders were to explore factors that may be influencing gas and diesel prices in BC since 2015, including refining and retail margins, as well as factors that contribute to retail and wholesale price fluctuations, such as access to refineries, the amount of fuel in storage, and refinery and pipeline capacity. So they were going pretty much everywhere on this. Now, the commission was to explore mechanisms that the province could use to moderate price fluctuation increases. Now, Werner Antweiler, who is a professor at the Sauder School of Business at the University of BC, noted that one of the challenges is that BC remains a peripheral market in North America with only two local fuel sources, that being the refineries in Burnaby as well as Prince George. It also relies heavily on Alberta for refined fuel products that can be constrained by refinery outages and space on the Trans Mountain pipeline. Both mean higher costs for transportation via truck or rail from Alberta or further afield in markets in the U.S. Antweiler also said that the commission heard interesting information on what was driving prices, including that in the Lower Mainland, higher retail margins were largely accounted for by the high cost of land. On the wholesale side, factors such as increased costs related to BC's low carbon fuel standards were also cited by industry. However, the inquiry has found that there is a significant unexplained difference of about 13 cents per liter in the price of gas in southern BC compared to the rest of the Pacific Northwest. The Utilities Commission Chair and CEO David Morton said, quote, "The prices in the Metro Vancouver area are higher by unexplained 13 cents per liter, and they're higher than they would be expected under more competitive conditions, and the higher price differentials cannot be explained by economic theory or justified by known factors in the market. We didn't look at the taxes, we removed the taxes and looked at the portion of the price that doesn't include taxes, and then from that we determined the 13 cent unexplained difference." Now, the review added that BC's wholesale gas market is, quote, "not truly competitive, with high levels of market concentration and high barriers to entry, with retail prices that can be controlled by just five refiner marketers." Despite this, the review found that there was no evidence to suggest collusion among retail operators or cartel behavior, as Horgan had previously suggested. However, critics such as the Canadian Taxpayers Federation have said that the commission report is pointless because it was barred from investigating government policies that affect prices, including taxes, which amount to as much as 40 cents per liter in some parts of BC. Now, under the inquiry's terms of reference, the BCUC had the power to compel oil companies to explain prices. However, several major producers resisted sharing information about refining and retail margins, citing, quote, "competitive sensitivity." So while Horgan is moving forward on energy, prices continue to climb. Now, the hope is that when projects like Site C and LNG Canada bear fruit, the extra tax revenue will be used to offset costs for consumers. And all in all, when it comes down to it, there are worse problems to have right now.
And when you look at it, 13 cents on the surface doesn't seem like much, but when you factor in taxes on the gas side of it, that's how you wind up with the $1.70 price per liter. It was good also that this inquiry mentions that the restrained capacity of the Trans Mountain pipeline is a limiting factor. It, of course, is something that should go without saying for anybody who has had a look at economics, but I think most people at the end of the day are just more concerned about filling up their gas tanks in the lower mainland. And, you know, you'd have to wonder at what point the prices would break their back and they'd cry out in it. But I guess $1.70 is par for the course at times in terms of high gas prices. I don't know what it is now, but I think the more interesting thing about this is when it comes to the utility commission's price, you know, we always hear, and we, you know, we haven't heard much out of this NDP government in quite a while in BC. And we were chatting about this in production this week with this, is that, yeah, there's really not that many BC stories that are generating much radar at all on the mainstream media, and let alone ones that need to be corrected. And when you look at things that affect people most, it comes down to costs. And one of those costs, of course, is hydro bills, electricity. And when you're looking at a $150 increase, that's definitely not making life more affordable. And people are going to have lots of questions about that. So, you know, if we look at what's been happening, I think we can take it back to basics and say that money in the pocket is what matters at the end of the day. And whether it's that you're paying $1.70 in the lower mainland at the high point, or if you're going to be paying an extra $150 for electricity per year by 2023, then that's something that we should definitely be focusing on here. But this is something that people will hopefully notice when it comes time to go vote again in BC.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is something that it's kind of been creeping up on people. And I think a lot of people living these days know that pretty much everything is more expensive when it comes to groceries or gas or their fuel for their home heating, or even just their taxes on their property bills. Everything has been going up. So anywhere that we can actually mitigate costs going up will make things more affordable for people. So the fact that the BC government seems to be, you know, at least trying to appear that they're heading in that direction is a good thing, but whether they can actually do something about the prices is another thing altogether. And trying to masquerade BC Hydro rates increasing with a very minuscule decline, saying that, oh yes, it'll be more affordable now, except the next year where it'll be going back up again, it just kind of throws that misdirection out there, and the media kind of picks up on that. But we haven't really been seeing that much out of the BC government this summer so far, and we're hoping that the media will continue to cover what they're going to be doing, because it is very important, and we're reaching the half mark of this minority government, and who knows how long it'll continue to go on for. While the Greens seem to be still criticizing the NDP government at every move, they still seem content to support them in the legislature.
Yeah, and, you know, perhaps John Horgan was right, that it is a strong, stable minority government.
It certainly seems to be appearing that way.
All right, so we're going to move on to Alberta right now and a new legal challenge coming out of the province. But before we do that, I'll just mention our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext. And that's where you can support the podcast if you want. So for $2 a month at the price of a cup of coffee, you can continue to help us do our job here of removing bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you continue to help us do that, and you can have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the week. Now, in case you're wondering what we're going to be doing with this, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we reflect the news of the month in a candid way and provide our opinion on where affairs are headed next. And at $50 a month, you can expect online town halls hosted every quarter. Topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. We also do have an option where you can make a one-time contribution via PayPal as well, and you can learn more about that and the Patreon option at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. All right, so moving on into Alberta this week, this headline came out, didn't generate too much attention because there was a lot of other noise in the province generated by the opposition NDP and their friends in big labor and the unions. But this headline is that Alberta ministers slam Bill C-69 proclamation and vow legal challenge. So this is referring to the federal government's Bill C-69 that has now been proclaimed into law. And as a bit of a refresher, Bill C-69 is the NEB, National Energy Board, replacement. It will effectively look at all new energy and transportation projects. And what makes this one particularly damning, at least for the energy industry and pipelines, is that when a new project is proposed, all upstream emissions, that is not only the emissions that come from building the project and displacing the ground where the project was built, but also all of the emissions from the goods that are created from the end product need to be taken into account when looking at approval for these projects. Now, Alberta has launched a constitutional challenge against this bill, now that it's been proclaimed into law. And this is the bill that the UCP government has called the No More Pipelines Act. In a statement from Justice Minister Doug Schweitzer and Energy Minister Sonia Savage, the Alberta government said that, quote, "This is a dark day for Alberta and Canada as a whole. This act is an unconstitutional attack on Alberta and our vital economic interests. It will make it virtually impossible for any future pipelines and other critical infrastructure projects that Canadians depend on. Under the Constitution, Alberta has clear and sole jurisdiction over the development of our natural resources." So as you can see there, the government feels though it is an intrusion into the decisions that Alberta is warranted to make in the Federation of Canada. Now, the ministers also warned that this act will cause more investment to move to the U.S. and other more friendly jurisdictions for energy development. And, you know, looking back at this bill, the Senate, when it was being amended after it had passed the House of Commons, the Senate proposed 188 amendments to Bill C-69. The government accepted 99 of them. Now, it's highly irregular for the Senate to submit so many amendments and have the government not pull back on the bill entirely, or even just rewrite it so that its major sticking components have been struck. And the federal government just proceeded straight ahead on this one. And, you know, you'd think it might just be Alberta that's upset about this, but over the past months, 9 of 10 provinces have registered their opposition in whole or to parts of the bill. And even during the Alberta election, the United Conservatives, the NDP, the Liberals, and the Alberta Party, four political parties of all varying political stripes here in Alberta, oppose C-69. And that says something when you have the New Democrats and the UCP opposing a piece of federal legislation. And, you know, we can look at what the political party said, but this doesn't even begin to touch on industry, Indigenous groups, unions, workers, and others, and just in general Canadians who do ultimately oppose Bill C-69. And, you know, in response to this challenge, the Trudeau government sent out the Finance Minister, Bill Morneau, and he issued a statement to CTV News saying, well, I mean, I could let the listeners guess what he said, because it is a very similar theme to what we've been talking about for the last number of weeks and the way the federal government wants the election campaign to go. Bill Morneau said that the Harper government gutted environmental protections, eroded public trust, discouraged investment, and made it harder, not easier, for major projects to get built in Canada. Premier Kenney and Andrew Scheer want to weaken regulations to help their oil industry friends, but weakening rules that protect the environment and people is not the way to build an industry. It makes no economic sense. And here we have it. We're seeing two very parallel worlds here, one in the east and one in energy-producing jurisdictions, where they are continually at a clash in terms of what they view should be done to the economic interests. And, you know, we say economic interests, but in reality, a strong natural resources sector is in the vital economic interests of the entire Canadian country and everybody in Canada. And because of that, that's why we're seeing these two parallel worlds. And we also need to note that when was the last time a provincial government put forward a constitutional challenge to a federal government, let alone during an election year? Now, the battle of C-69 will be one of the many dividing forces in the coming fall election. And, you know, when we look at this, if this was perhaps reversed, if there was a conservative government in power and, say, Quebec or maybe one of the eastern provinces had launched a constitutional challenge against a conservative government, I think we would be seeing a complete reversal of what we saw this week in the media regarding this, because, as we have said many times before, constitutional challenges are big because the Constitution of Canada is, for all intents and purposes, the core fabric of what makes Canada our country. And anytime there's a constitutional challenge to that, everybody, the government, the opposition, and of course the media should be taking note of that. And that's why we're talking about that this week, because there really wasn't much coverage at all in the media about this when we're potentially days away from the election being called.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that Alberta itself is expected to go very much conservative. And there were a few surprises in the last election in certain parts of the province that didn't go conservative. But I think it's widely expected that most of the province will go conservative in the next election. And I think that's probably leading to the Liberals moving ahead with C-69, because they don't feel like there's anything that they have to lose by doing it. And that's something that the media hasn't really picked up on, is the apparent hypocrisy with the Trudeau government announcing these sorts of things for Alberta, as opposed for somewhere like BC, where a lot more of the seats are in play, or in Ontario, where there's the most amount of seats in any province, or in Quebec, where there's always a battleground. So it really comes down to the fact that the Trudeau government seems like they can do this because they feel there's no consequence if they don't. And I think the media hasn't really picked up on that angle. And you're absolutely right that if it was the opposite place, or if it was the Quebec government that launched something similar to this against a conservative government, that we would be hearing about it a lot more. And we haven't heard very much about Bill C-69 at all, especially in the national media. It certainly might have been there in Alberta, but not in the rest of the country.
Indeed. And, you know, when it comes down to it, Alberta's 34 seats out of 338. And that's, you know, you can do the math on that. That's about 10%. And, you know, it's not really that consequential when they're all going to go blue potentially for the opposition as it is right now. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens in that race. But of course, we have been dancing around the potential hypothetical election call that hasn't happened for quite some time, even though the campaign has been going on. And there's more questions about that this week with the debate. So what do we got on that?
Yeah, exactly. There's been lots of news surrounding this upcoming federal election, as we've talked about, and most of it seems to be centered on Trudeau and the Liberal government. And as we've said, despite not officially calling the election yet, the Liberals appear to be acting as if the campaign is already underway. It's been noted that several federal ministers, as well as MPs, have continued their cross-country spending announcement tour last week. In total, 330 spending commitments on everything from fixing up bus stops in London, Ontario, to building new dressing rooms and a hockey rink in Western PEI, to funding a youth exchange program to be run by Tides Canada. And in our BC story, I already detailed the spending commitment made towards LNG Canada. Now, those total 330 spending commitments were made from just August 19th to August 25th, and they total $2.85 billion. Now, for the week before that, from August 11th to the 18th, Liberal MPs and ministers made 595 spending commitments worth a total of $4.9 billion. Now, under Canada's fixed-date elections law, the earliest that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau could call this fall's election would be September 1st, and the latest would be September 15th. Now, once he calls the election, all those spending announcements would stop. And it's been noted that that pace and scale of the spending announcements by the Trudeau government is significantly greater than a similar spending announcement program the Harper Conservative government engaged in just before the 2015 general election. In the entire month before Stephen Harper called the election on August 2nd, 2015, Conservative ministers and MPs made a total of 604 spending commitments worth just a combined $1.4 billion. So despite acting like the election is already set in stone, one has to look at the underlying clues to show that Trudeau will be unlikely to call the election sooner rather than later. Now, as of yesterday, the amount of candidate nominations shows a huge lack of preparedness for the NDP for the upcoming election, at just 148 nominations out of 338 ridings. And the Liberals, at 248, trail the Conservatives at 332. Even smaller parties have nominated more candidates for the upcoming election than the Liberals, which shows that they probably aren't planning on calling it until the last moment possible. Now, despite all the spending and campaigning, Trudeau looks like he will be dodging criticism from his opponents. He will be attending two official debates, one of which is the English debate on October 7th, and this is led by five journalists: Althea Raj from HuffPost Canada, Susan Delacourt from the Toronto Star, Rosemary Barton from CBC News, Donna Friesen from Global News, and Lisa LaFlamme from CTV News. So for those keeping score at home, yes, the English debate leaders are all female, and three out of the five are from left-leaning outlets, with Friesen and LaFlamme occupying the center. Now, the French debate will be on October 10th and will be moderated by Patrice Roy from Radio Canada and feature journalists from Le Devoir, Le Soleil, La Presse, and L'Actualité. Now, the Canadian Debates Production Partnership, or the CDPP, is setting up the official debates. Now, the CDPP is comprised of HuffPost Canada, HuffPost Quebec, CTV News, CBC News, Radio Canada, Global News, the Toronto Star and Torstar, La Presse, Le Devoir, and L'Actualité. The participation of HuffPost Canada means that for the first time, a digital-only news organization is part of the production group for the leaders' debates. So while Trudeau seems happy to join in the official debates organized by center-left organizations, he won't actually confirm whether he will attend or be a no-show to the first federal leaders' debate next month. That debate is sponsored by Maclean's Magazine and City TV and hosted by journalist Paul Wells, will take place on September 12th in Toronto. And for those listening, that is, yes, just 2 weeks away. So not saying whether he's going to be joining it or not is going to be cutting it pretty close. Now, Trudeau has also not confirmed his attendance at the planned Monk debate on foreign policy on October 1st, with spokesperson Braden Cayley saying that they are still, quote, mulling over their options. Now, the Conservatives released a press release on Tuesday suggesting that Trudeau is, quote, hiding and running away from debates ahead of the next election, saying, quote, just because Trudeau has a lot to run away and hide from doesn't mean that he should. Now, the attacks come days after both Liberals and Conservatives revealed new ads where both leaders wore light blue button-up shirts to introduce their party's campaign slogans. And seemingly inspired from the same directional theme, the Liberals settled on Choose Forward, while the Tories picked It's Time for You to Get Ahead. And interestingly enough, the Greens have also drawn from the same pool with theirs, which is not left, not right, forward together. So while all parties, other than the floundering NDP, are gearing up for the election, Trudeau seems to be dodging questions and debates, as well as promising spending that might not even go through after the election. So if he wants to campaign, he should just call the election.
And, you know, we mentioned that the government should call the election for their own campaigning that they're doing. But we also need to remember that by calling the election, this triggers rules for third-party groups as well and their campaigning that is taking place in the lead-up to the race as well. So there's many reasons to call the election sooner rather than later. But I just want to touch on the debates story for a moment, because you'll recall that I think it was back in 2015 or maybe 2011, there was the idea of having more debates, and at the time, the governing Conservatives were not sure if they were going to attend. They did end up attending all of the debates. And, you know, there was a huge media presence once again on that, and we're not seeing that this time with Trudeau. And we also need to take note that, yes, as we see in the English language debate, all of the debate leaders are female. Three of five are from left-leaning outlets, and Huffington Post Canada is included in that. But what many don't realize is that Huffington Post Canada is an American-owned outlet. Meanwhile, Maclean's Magazine, which is owned by Rogers Media, which is very Canadian, was left out from the official debates entirely. And that's something that should really concern all people who are going to be watching these debates as well. Because this, when you look at this, if you compare Huffington Post to Maclean's, they are two very different publications. And at the end of the day, you have to ask, would you rather have an organization that is Canadian-based and owned by Canadians in on the debate side, or would you rather have one that is American-based and American-owned in on the debates? And, you know, I think even if they did add Maclean's to it, it would shift the debate more to the center than as we have right now, because three of five of the debate leaders are indeed from left-leaning outlets. And, you know, it doesn't take much to realize that. And you look at coverage from Rosemary Barton and Susan Delacourt on the SNC-Lavalin scandal, and this is just cherry-picking one idea. As soon as these allegations broke in February and there was the question of whether or not Jody Wilson-Raybould was going to stay in the party, these two journalists minimized that and ultimately pushed and said, yeah, this is going to be no big deal. It's going to blow over. And that's who's in this debate here.
Yeah, exactly. And another note to make is that you also mentioned Huffington Post, which is owned by American companies, whereas Maclean's is left out and they're Canadian-owned. Another big news outlets that's Canadian-owned that was left out of this was Post Media, who, of course, owns the National Post and Sun newspapers that are in the major cities. And definitely a big part of the Canadian media is Post Media, and they were left out of this completely as well. And it's interesting to note that there doesn't seem to be very much of a balance on this debate partnership that's been created. It's very center-left seeming. So the fact that Trudeau has confirmed his attendance to those, but not any other debates, is definitely very suspect.
Yeah, you definitely can't forget Post Media, because that covers, of course, here in Alberta, the Calgary Herald and the Edmonton Journal, which are the two biggest newspapers in the province. Plus, you mentioned all the Sun newspapers as well. And, you know, covering that, I think I think Post Media sees more eyes than the rest of these ones do, except for maybe the CBC. So it's a definitely interesting story that should have gained more coverage than it did. And we'll have to wait and see what happens if Trudeau goes to these debates. In my opinion, there should be four debates in total in English and French on both sides, one with all of the political parties that have official party status, that is more than 12 seats, and then another debate in both English and French with just the prime minister and the opposition leader to let people know who exactly they're going to be choosing from. But I think we can move on from this into our firing line segment, which, of course, talks about more commitments from the Trudeau government, in particular the Environment Minister, Catherine McKenna, in that this week she announced Canada's pledge to back off from freezing the carbon tax at $50 a ton. And our firing line segment is the story in which wasn't covered in the media or was covered horribly in the media. And in this case, it's a bit of both, because we didn't really hear much about the backing off of the carbon tax at $50 a ton, but the media did leave out one key detail when it came to the climate change platform and the Brazilian fires. So the carbon tax was one of the policies that was implemented by the Trudeau government and was in the 2015 hashtag Real Change platform. The logic being is that, of course, if all of the actions of the population that are damaging to the environment are taxed, people will stop or reduce them. The difference, though, is that in practice, everything that we buy, our gas, the gasoline used to bring groceries to the grocery store, and most importantly, the fuel that we use to heat our homes in the winter can't exactly be switched off. It would be like going back to the pre-industrial age if we wanted to severely reduce the carbon footprint in Canada. It's just not happening overnight. Now, the provinces were given the choice of either implementing their own carbon tax or going along with the federal plan. Alberta's former NDP government brought in their own carbon tax that was subsequently repealed with the UCP's first act of government, the Carbon Tax Repeal Act. Meanwhile, Ontario, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba are challenging the federal carbon tax in court. And with this, the Ontario Court of Appeal ruled that the carbon tax was indeed constitutional. And this week, Ontario just announced that they were taking their fight for the carbon tax to the Supreme Court of Canada to see whether or not the highest court in all of Canada will deem the carbon tax constitutional or unconstitutional. Saskatchewan also filed a similar ruling with the Supreme Court this past spring, and Alberta will be doing the same should the Trudeau government be reelected and a carbon tax put on Alberta. Now, you're probably wondering, why are we talking about this? Well, Environment Minister Catherine McKenna has backed away from the government's pledge to freeze the carbon tax at $50 a ton after the year 2022. She now says that a reelected Liberal government would review the levy with provinces before deciding how to proceed. And it's worth noting that a $50 per ton carbon tax equates roughly to 11 cents per liter on gasoline, just as an example. And everybody pays this: rail operators, truck companies, and you. And this is all going to add up for anything that you buy or anything that you do that involves in using a vehicle with any number of wheels that uses hydrocarbons as its fuel. This doesn't even begin to factor in the cost of electricity and heating fuel and the carbon tax on natural gas plants, new natural gas plants. The Parliamentary Budget Office also issued a report this week saying that the carbon tax would need to increase to $102 per ton to meet the international target for reducing greenhouse gas emissions if the carbon tax was the sole environmental policy. So that would effectively mean that if the government wanted to reach their targets of reducing greenhouse gases, the price of the carbon tax after 2022 would need to double. And it's not out of the realm of possibilities to see a reelected Trudeau government doing that within 5 years, bringing it up $10 per ton every year. Other policies, of course, could include technological developments, but in action this week, the government sent $15 million to Brazil to help with their wildfire situation, in addition to the $26.5 million offered by the G7 group of nations. Now, Brazil, it's an interesting thing to talk about, and we don't really think about it all that much. The catch, though, in regards to the Brazilian fires, is that this year has seen 35% more wildfires than in the last 8 years on average. And, you know, eight's a bit of an odd number to do when it comes to averaging. But there's one thing that was left out by the media on this, and that this 35% increase and the amount of fires that we're seeing this year and we've seen in the last 8 years is far below the number of fires that we saw between 2003 and 2010. The recent number is, of course, what the media and governments like the Trudeau government and the government under Macron in France want the public to focus on. It furthers the cause of climate change. It provides a mental image and allows the media and themselves and the governments like Trudeau's government to virtue signal to the public with G7 communiques, aid, media stories, and most importantly, gives the governments green lights to act at home on climate change. All of the context is missing, of course, because the numbers are lower than they were between 2003 and 2010, and that they are above average for the last 8 years is something that really wasn't talked about in the mainstream media. We had to go to the New York Times to get this reporting, of all places. It also probably factors in that the media and Trudeau and Macron, amongst other G7 leaders, dislike Brazilian President Bolsonaro's policies, as he's a right-wing populist and that he initially turned down aid for the fires. The fires in Brazil are bad. There's no other way to say it. They're burning land that has already been cut to make way for new farmland because Brazil wants to turn parts of the Amazon rainforest into what effectively is going to be farmland to farm corn and soy and other products to that effect. And, you know, the burning of the Amazon happens yearly, and we should be paying attention every year and not just this 1 year, because that's what's happening here. So back in Canada, McKenna says that it's always been the plan to plot the future of the carbon tax, signed an agreement with every province in 2016 except Saskatchewan. And whether this was the plan in 2016 or it's a plan this week, a carbon tax beyond $50 per ton is likely going to be the reality with the re-elected Trudeau Liberal government. And when you factor in what we see with the Brazilian wildfires, it's just some context that's been missing in the media this week, and that's why this is our firing line.
Yeah, exactly. I think anyone who's been looking in the media will know that the Brazilian fires are really bad. Not only is it taking away prime rainforest, something that is a very huge carbon sink for the entire planet, but it's also going to be ending up replacing it with farmland, mostly for products that are either going to go towards animal husbandry, such as, you know, ranching for cows, or will provide food for animal ranching. And as we all know, animals, you know, are quite a huge polluter as well when it comes to carbon pollution. So it's a bit of a double whammy here, in that not only are we losing the rainforest, we're also getting the increased carbon pollution from the fires, but it's also going to be ending up turning into a carbon polluter anyways. The rainforest in Brazil has steadily been shrinking, and it's not just this year that it's been happening. But if you looked at just what the media has been talking about, they would lead you to believe that that would be the case. And it's actually not. Ever since parts of the rainforest have been discovered, where there's been lots of mining going on, it's been going on for decades now, and it hasn't stopped, and it's likely not going to stop. And throwing money at the problem is not going to stop the problem to begin with. And the fact that they're using this as more of an incentive to go with their own carbon policy is just astounding that there's that leap of logic. We talked a bit about transitioning Asian companies off of coal towards LNG. That is a tangible benefit that you can see with carbon reductions. Whereas this, there's not really much tangible benefit there because it's something that's not going to change. And the fact that Catherine McKenna was trying to promote this as a reason why the carbon tax should go up is quite frankly astounding, and it should have received much more media coverage than it did.
Yeah, and you know, at the end of the day, there are better environmental policies to lower emissions. Carbon tax is a tax on everything and everyone, and it affects the people at the end of the day. The government says that they're going to get more money back than they insert into the carbon tax, which of course means it becomes a government expense. And you know, whether or not some of that is direct to green energy, as we saw in BC and we saw in Alberta with the carbon tax, it didn't happen. So carbon taxes start off with good intentions, but at the end of the day, they are rarely implemented in a way that has an environmental benefit. And, you know, as they always say, they like them to be revenue neutral. That doesn't happen either. So this is something that should concern all Canadians, especially as we are about to head into the election campaign. And I think that leads us nicely into our word of the week, one of the biggest debates we're going to see.
Exactly. And our word of the week this week is debate, and it is defined as a form of discussion on a particular topic in a public meeting or legislative assembly in which opposing arguments are put forward. And certainly there's lots of opposing arguments being put forward in this pre-election campaign surrounding many different things, such as the carbon tax, certainly environmental policies, and lots going on with different funding. And, you know, there's been lots of debates going on, and there will be debates happening, which we will see if all of the party leaders decide to show up to them, including our prime minister. And we will have to be keeping close eye on them just to see what exactly our leaders are going to be talking about and what they're going to be trying to campaign on.
Indeed, and I think that pretty much wraps up this episode of Western Context. So if you want full show notes, you can find that at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any podcast listener out there. Just head on over to westerncontext.ca/subscribe to figure out how to do that. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where the show is posted and most of the stories that we talk about through the entire week at Western Context. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context. So we'll see you then.
And we'll always make sure to look through all of the news of the week that the mainstream media talks about and some that they don't talk about to make sure that you have the full context needed. Put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week in September for another episode of Western Context.